Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's a big week in the news on Wall Street, in Washington, beyond. Obama pushing for health care reform, Rush Limbaugh called the head of the GOP, and more hot words over gay marriage in California. At a White House reform summit, President Obama said health care must change.
The status quo is the one option that's not on the table, and those who seek to block any reform at all, any reform at any costs, will not prevail this time around.
Rush Limbaugh stirs it up after a call for Obama's economic plans to fail.
What is in this? What possibly is in this that any of us want to succeed?
And California's high court takes up the state's Proposition 8 ban on gay marriage with anger in the streets.
But if this Supreme Court does not overturn Prop 8 entirely, there will be a million of us on the street nationally fighting for our rights. We are not going away, and we will not be invisible.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Are we hitting bottom yet? Where's the hope in this picture? Can you feel it out there? Joining us now from New York is Diane Brady, senior editor at Businessweek magazine. Diane, great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom.
With us from Washington is Matthew Continetti, associate editor at the Weekly Standard. Matt, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Diane, and Matthew.
Diane, let's start to you because the economy is the envelope for everything these days. These new unemployment numbers out today, over 8% now, 1,000 jobs lost last month. How's the street taking that on board, for starters?
Well, it was actually, I think, slightly better than expected, but there's no question it's grim going forward, and we're seeing a lot more companies preparing to lay off. You're seeing more and more articles about the Warn Act and everything else, so it's not looking good. People are scared.
And we have seen all kinds of interesting talk and indicators and scary stuff out of so many stock prices companies this week. GM, I want to ask you about, let me go to Obama earlier in the week saying, you know, don't pay so much attention to these enormous wobbles in the markets.
You know, the stock market is sort of like a tracking pole in politics. You know, it bobs up and down day to day. And if you spend all your time worrying about that, then you're probably going to get the long-term strategy wrong.
Matthew Continetti, how do you see the markets right around the world down and kind of downer this week? And the president's saying maybe it's time to buy. Good market reflexes there?
Well, I think that if Obama's numbers were as low as the stock markets, he'd show a little bit more concern about the decline in the markets, which is ongoing. It's not, as the president says, bobbing up and down. It's a precipitous and steep decline. And the question then becomes, what are the policies that are going to arrest that decline and bring back economic recovery and growth? And the president believes that his stimulus plan is the start of that. But going forward, some of his other policies, including this cap and trade scheme, you know, which will basically increase energy prices across the board, or even the Employee Free Choice Act, which will increase unionization. And whenever you have high rates of unionization, you also have high rates of unemployment or higher rates of unemployment. Policies like that, I think, will not do anything to get the economy back to recovery.
Jack Beatty, we hear John Cornyn, Republican senator, now saying freeze government spending, throw the brakes on this big package supposed to be cleared through early next week. What about that, Jack? Bad economy, you know, red and redder in the ink front, time to throw the brakes on government spending?
Well, of course, that would guarantee a long duration for this recession. The only way out of the recession, of course, is to spend. You know, the administration is trying to be at once realistic about the depths of the crisis and to instill confidence in its plans to get us out of it. But confidence has fled. Moody's says a pall continues to hang over global business confidence as it has since sentiment collapsed last fall. There's no confidence to be found in the news from Eastern Europe that those economies are collapsing. No confidence. confidence to be found in GE's bottom line, GM's imminent bankruptcy, AIG's need for more billions. And I think the administration, its own numbers aren't inspiring confidence. For example, it predicts a minus 1.2% growth this year. The blue chip forecast is the average minus 1.9% growth. Next year, the administration predicts plus 3% growth. The blue chips, 2% growth. These improbably rosy scenarios don't inspire confidence. And then the stimulus plan, well, it'll help, but it's not nowhere near robust enough to inspire more than hope. The bank rescue plan seems to have dashed rather than inspired confidence. The housing plan is going to help people, but nowhere near enough to really make a difference. But when you think about why should we be confident in a system that has gone this far off the rails, which is why I think small matters, that seemingly small matters, could help to revive confidence.
Like?
I take confidence, for example, in the new budget's call for an increase of 44% in the budget of the SEC. If part of our problem is we just don't believe these people on Wall Street, and Robert Chillow says trust is at the essence, we've got getting more cops on the beat could be a start toward regaining some confidence.
Diane Brady, how about it? On the one hand, the market's been way down, as Matt Continetti says. On the other, we do hear voices out of Wall Street saying, well, when the stimulus package really begins finally to click in, maybe that's the way toward return to growth. What are you hearing?
I think the mood is such right now that people are looking for excuses to sell. And that's one thing with the president. He's got the power to do further damage. I don't think he has the power right now to do a lot of good. It's not like the days where, you know, Alan Greenspan would smile and the markets would lift. So I think what's happening is there's just real fear and paralysis. And when you see a stock like GE basically trading for, I think the cost of two light bulbs was the classic comparison, you know something's wrong because the fundamentals there don't seem to justify it.
And what about GM? The talk about bankruptcy, is it finally looking to them like it may be their best solution? Do you see a prepackaged bankruptcy where they survive on the other side?
What happened, the reason they didn't want a bankruptcy, they argued that people would no longer buy GM cars because they would lose faith. Well, that's already, we've lost faith in GM at this point. We know Chrysler's in trouble. So what a bankruptcy would do would basically accelerate what they need to do. They have to get a deal with these bondholders. They have to get a deal with the unions. So the fact is $30 billion is not enough to save this company. U.S. taxpayers aren't going to be pouring AIG-style billions into it. They really have to do something, and the hope is they can get out of it quickly with government help.
British Prime Minister Gordon Brown in Washington this week talking with President Obama, urging him to recognize, and everybody, that the present economy, the bad economy, is not confined within U.S. borders.
We're looking ahead to the G20 in London in April because a bad bank anywhere can affect good banks everywhere. So we've got to root out the problems that exist in other parts of the world as well, set principles for the banking system for the future, and make sure that the banks subscribe to lending agreements where they actually increase the lending that is available to citizens in every country.
Gordon Brown there, Matt Continetti, talking about systemic answers to this globally, particularly around banking. Jack Beatty says he's comforted by one thing, and that's 44% more dollars for the SEC. If that cop is back on the beat, if we get some systemic fixes in the works, is that what you see us needing, Matt?
Well, I think I'd agree more with Gordon Brown, the sense that the root of all of this is in the banks. It was in the popping of the housing bubble, which brought down the value of all of these mortgage-backed securities that the banks had loaded up on. And thus, because the banks were so over-leveraged, many of them became insolvent. So until you correct the banking problem, until you find a way for the banking sector to deleverage all of this bad debt, you're not going to get to the root of the problem, regardless of how big the SEC is. And what troubles me most is that the Obama administration, the Obama Treasury, still has yet to actually take on this challenge. I think they've begun the process of beginning these stress tests. But I think the markets, and more or less any cogent observer of the financial news, has already performed a stress test. We know that institutions like Citigroup, Bank of America, they're in big trouble. And there needs to be a way to get this bad debt off the books. Until that happens, the economy isn't going to recover.
Diane Brady, what about the approach on the banks? Timothy Geithner, are Geithner et al., and even going back before him to Paulson, are they too close to Wall Street, too hesitant to wade in deeper, really clear up the problem?
Well, I certainly think Tim Geithner could use some public speaking lessons in terms of just projecting an aura of confidence when he speaks. Is he close to Wall Street? Yes, he is, obviously, but that's not necessarily a problem. The issue we're having, let's take AIG, for example. Mm-hmm. The fact is nobody's really been made to feel the pain there. The stock is 35 cents, so the shareholders will probably be wiped out. But why are we respecting all these contracts and making sure that everybody's made whole while this company basically is a zombie? We need to see some more action out of Washington and things like that. And I want to go back to Europe for a second, mm-hmm. if you don't mind, Tom.
Yes, please.
I think it's fascinating if you look at what's happened there. They're in a worse position than us in many ways, and you're seeing kind of a curtain raiser on the type of protectionism, isolationism. One thing that happened this week was Hungary wanted a bailout. It was rejected. And so you're seeing the whole notion of the European Union come under a lot of strain. One monetary policy. You can't have many, many fiscal policies, which is what is needed right now. And I think we're going to see a lot of trouble with the European Union and the whole concept of the euro. And it certainly, I think, should be troubling for people in the U.S. that they're not bandying together and they're very much saying, okay, I'm Germany. You solve your problems, Hungary, and we'll solve ours.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Stocks in the tank, GM on the brink, health reform in the White House, the GOP, and Democrats in a lather over rush. We've got news all over the place this week. Diane Brady is with us from Business Week magazine. Matt Continetti from the Weekly Standard. Jack Beatty's here. The flap over Limbaugh goes back to mid-February when he said on his show he wants the president to fail.
I want everything he's doing to fail. His stimulus is not about creating jobs. It's about, oh, we've been through this. I'm getting blue in the face.
Blue in the face. Rahm Emanuel, President Obama's chief of staff, jumped on it on Sunday morning on CBS's Face the Nation after the CPAC, Conservative Political Action Group, was meeting in Washington, talked about what he called Limbaugh's perceived leadership of the GOP.
He's asked for President Obama and called for President Obama to fail. That's his view. And that's what he's enunciated. And whenever a Republican criticizes him, they have to run back and apologize to him and say they were misunderstood. He is the voice and the intellectual force and energy behind the Republican Party, and he has been upfront about what he views and hasn't stepped back from that, which is he hopes for failure.
Okay, and then Rush at that CPAC saying, what about it? People call for other parties to fail. Let's listen to Rush Limbaugh speaking to that call for failure.
There's some people you can't say that you want the president to fail. Ladies and gentlemen of the United States, the Democrat Party has actively not just sought the failure of Republican presidents and policies and now wars for the first time. The Democrat Party doesn't stop at failure. Talk to Judge Robert Bork, talk to Justice Clarence Thomas about how they try to destroy lives, reputations, and character. And I'm supposed to say, I don't want the president to fail.
And one little bit more in that arc, it got very hot for RNC Chair Michael Steele on CNN, talking about Rush Limbaugh's incendiary and ugly before he apologized.
Rush Limbaugh is an entertainer. Rush Limbaugh, his whole thing is entertainment. Yes, it's incendiary.
Right.
Yes, it's ugly.
Matt Continetti, who is in charge here?
No one. There is no leader to the Republican Party. You know, it's well understood that the leader of a party is the president in office, or if it's a divided government, you have the head of the Congressional Party, which in the past has been Newt Gingrich as the Speaker of the House, or Nancy Pelosi when the mm-hmm. Democrats controlled the House and Bush still had the White House. So now the Republican Party finds itself in a position where it holds no power whatsoever. And so what it has is it has a set of leaders, people like Boehner and McConnell, who manage the GOP congressional minority, a few governors, you know, Sanford, in South Carolina, mm-hmm. Huntsman, Crist, Schwarzenegger, in Florida and California. And it has some commentators. And, of course, it has Michael Steele, who is the chairman of the Republican National Committee and not the leader of the GOP. Michael Steele makes a big mistake. But it's certainly not Rush Limbaugh because he's not an elected official. He's a commentator. He's a conservative. He's a broadcaster. But he's not. Commentators aren't leaders, as we all know, being commentators.
Though his numbers, apparently, for his radio show almost doubled since the whole thing unfolded. Jack Beatty, how do you read this whole fracas around Rush Limbaugh?
Well, Jay Leno had a good comment. He said, you know, last week there was a report that a massive asteroid was approaching the Earth. It weighed several tons, and it was spewing toxic gas. And he said, oh, no, I'm sorry, that's Rush Limbaugh. And the toxic gas, of course, is spreading over the Republican Party. He has, for his own commercial reasons, I'm sure, seized the microphone. And this is just gold for the Democrats. It's found gold, because that poison gas is especially poison among the independent voters who elected Barack Obama. They see Limbaugh for what he is, a polarizing figure, someone who wants the president to fail, which is to say, you want the country to fail. So I just think that this, and the way the Republican politicians have reacted, kowtowing to him, giving him this legitimacy, it's embarrassing. This is, you know, these guys can hardly stand up to terrorists when they're cowed by this lout with a microphone.
Diane Brady, how about it? For Rush Limbaugh want Obama to fail, to want the country to fail? Is that the way Wall Street's looking at it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just aware of the fact that, you know, he basically misquoted the Declaration of Independence and called it the preamble to the Constitution. So it's hard to take him seriously when that's how he kicks off his remarks. I'm surprised at the degree to which people pay attention to him. And certainly it's not out of character for Rush Limbaugh to talk about the president this way and to talk about the Democrats this way. So we're in scary times. People are not happy with what Obama has done, but I don't think the markets are reacting to Rush. They're reacting to things like housing and just the long-term health of this economy.
People maybe on Wall Street, though, if you look at the polls, the president's numbers are doing very well, even as Rush's audience is growing. Let's turn to our listeners. Strasburg, Virginia, Don. Don, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always enjoyed listening to your show.
Thanks, Don. What do you see?
Well, you were asking whether we saw any hope, and mm-hmm. I don't see any hope at this point. You know, I've been through a foreclosure and going through bankruptcy and lost my health insurance, and I look at the situation that the country faces, and between the money we spent on a war we didn't need to fight, and in addition to the ones that we did need to fight, and what we're looking at spending right now, it just seems to me that the country is facing the same kind of default and bankruptcy that I've just been through, and that's just the way it feels to me right now.
You got the full blast there, foreclosure, bankruptcy, no health care. How about the way the Obama administration is trying to dig in across this very large front? Is it not giving you some hope that they're beginning to address this, or do you see the wrong compass settings? What?
Well, you know, I look at what he's talking about for, you know, aiding the foreclosure. Well, there's a lot of us for whom that's not going to do any good. You know, we've already passed that point. We're already, you know, at the bottom, and I don't see any hope for a lot of us that have gone through this kind of thing. And those that are going to get some help, they may have been okay anyhow.
And health care, do you hear the sound of trumpets, you know, relief on the way in the summit this week?
Well, that's the reason I voted for Obama, is, you know, of anything that I think our government needs to do for us is to provide some kind of basic health care coverage, you know, not bells and whistles, but basic coverage. And that's the one thing that I'm hoping that that comes out of the Obama administration is a realization that this country needs to provide at least basic services without going into some of the areas, you know, spending all of this money to bail out corporations that took risks like the rest of us and, you know, need to suffer the consequences.
Don, you hang in there. We'll dig in right across that front, and thank you for your call. Here's President Obama at that health care summit in Washington yesterday, convening figures from right across the political, business, medical realms, saying, talking about plans to overhaul the medical system.
This time, there is no debate about whether all Americans should have quality, affordable health care. The only question is how. And the purpose of this forum is to start answering that question, to determine how we lower costs for everyone, improve quality for everyone, and expand coverage to all Americans. And our goal will be to enact comprehensive health care reform by the end of this year. That is our commitment. That is our goal.
But everybody knows it's rough out there at the summit. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Democrat from Rhode Island, looking back at the Harry and Louise ads that killed health care reform 15 years ago or so, used some dark humor to drive home the urgency of the current health care crisis.
We're past the Harry and Louise moment. We're at the Thelma and Louise moment. We are in the car. We are headed for the cliff.
In the car, headed for the cliff on healthcare. Jack Beatty, everybody was holding hands there yesterday, even the folks who sponsored those Harry and Louise ads that helped kill reform a decade and a half ago. What do you think about this beginning of a push for something this year to be on the table, Jack?
Well, it's very promising. Ron Wyden, the Democratic senator from Oregon, says that in 1993, the last time health care reform was tried, he said the businesses were saying that they couldn't survive health care reform. He said now they're saying they can't survive without it. And that's because, as the president said yesterday, something like a bankruptcy happens in America every 30 seconds, and businesses are among those bankrupts. The president It's rightly stressing the need to control costs. He does say increase coverage too, but the emphasis is on costs, and that is really because still 94% of voters have insurance. 84% of the population has it. So you've got to begin with controlling costs. My problem is when I look at the Obama plan, I see long-term strategies that might control costs, for example, computerization of healthcare records and things like that at the margin. But I don't see the big cost control mechanism that could really work. I mean, McKinsey and Company in 2007 did a big study, a cross-national analysis of healthcare, and it found that we were spending much more per capita on our healthcare than our GDP warranted, about $500 billion a year. Why? Why were we spending more? Well, higher input costs, they say, especially higher drug costs, higher profits, too heavy reliance on for-profit providers and insurers, higher administrative costs. All of those things, all of that private lattice work that uses up so much of this money is still going to be there in the Obama plan, which is why it seems to me that if you really are going to talk about controlling costs, you have to talk about single payer. I mean, it's off the table for ideological reasons, but I perhaps some caller could tell me, how do you control costs in the absence of it?
Diane Brady, do you see the business community worried enough now, with the example of GM and others out there struggling with healthcare costs, that there's enough common ground, maybe not all the way to single payer, but enough to get something significant done, and maybe even, as the president says, done this year? Or is this all going to fragment once it gets down to brass tacks?
I think the business community, in terms of employers, are very much on board with the idea of health care reform. The issue, as Jack alluded to, I think is the private insurers and very much the drug companies, because they're in this strange competitive position, basically, where they don't want the government to come in and start competing with them. They're quite happy to get more money poured into, say, Medicare, Medicaid, but ultimately, I think the issue is that you've got 50 state regulators. Washington is somewhat limited in that respect because everybody's bound by the states. And I think that you're going to have to really address the issue of the universality. I hope my Canadian accent isn't coming out there, but you really can't get reform unless that becomes the condition. I have seen progress. One thing that I think is very hopeful this year is the fact that people who become unemployed are not suddenly stuck with paying $800-$900 a month to continue their health care coverage. The government's now sharing that burden. And I think, such as for people like the last caller, that is a hopeful sign.
Let's get a call from Royal Oak, Michigan. And Carol, hi, Carol, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I want to talk to that guy that said he's given up hope. I'm not giving up hope. I was here for the last depression, and I know that everything recovered. What started things here in Detroit was a few smart people knew how to make cars, assembly lines, and how to get people to work together. And that talent is still there. Let's find it and let's dig it up and let's use it. And I think I'm for universal health care because to dispense that money, it goes a lot cheaper you know, like the way they do it with Medicare, than by through the insurance company. So why can't we do it?
Carol, Rush Limbaugh's, I think behind his critique is sort of the sense that, well, you know, those smart people, those next Henry Fords, aren't going to step up and do it under Obama's instincts, Obama's kind of policy. Are you worried about that or not?
I'm not worried about it. And I think Rush Limbaugh is a distraction. Let's find somebody who knows something.
All right. Carol, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Ellen in Middlebury, Vermont. Ellen, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm very happy to hear one of your commentators say that single payer is key to cost control and cost control is key to universality. Every study shows that, you know, single payer would cut out the middleman, which adds 30% of the cost. And that's why our insurance or our health care is the most expensive in the world. 62% of Americans, when surveyed, are for single payer. And I think it's the time for systematic fixes rather than Band-Aids. And this is true all across the board, whether it's banks or health care. I wonder, since the Republicans are in retreat, I feel this is not a time to hold back, yet I feel that Obama is holding out back in his proposals, and health care is a perfect example. They're going to, you know, fiddle with this and that, but we all know that what's actually adding costs to our health care, and Medicare for All would save, every study shows it would save about $400 billion a year, and we could cover everyone, and the public is for it. Maybe the special interests are not.
So you wish Obama would sort of put the pedal to the metal here, go further in that direction. Matt Continetti, you come out of the conservative Weekly Standard. You saw what happened 15 years ago. Americans were worried they'd lose personal control, and that was very powerful in the years since. An awful lot of people without good health insurance, and an awful lot of people, you know, got stuck in bad situations. Think the politics have changed on this, Matt, that maybe there's room for a more dramatic answer to the health care crisis?
I do believe the politics have changed, Tom. I do think the environment, especially with the economic crisis, is ripe for healthcare reform. I want to turn quickly to the issue of cost. I happen to agree with Jack that the costs are there, and a single payer system would limit costs. How would it limit costs? It would limit costs by decreasing supply, thus reducing demand. And what we've seen in single payer systems, as implemented in England or in Canada, is you have a reduction in the types of treatments, or you have to wait for, you know, a regular checkup or something, and that's how they lower costs.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm out there and covered now, and I'm already facing all kinds of breaks being put on, you know, everybody.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not as though everything's just flowing down right now.
That's right.
To anyone who needs it, and a whole lot of people have nothing.
Right, and Tom, there are two ways to do it. You either go the full single payer, or you start having the consumer, the medical consumer, bearing more of the cost of his medical decisions and treatments as an individual, thus reducing demand that way. And that would be the Republican solution, but the Republicans aren't in control of anything right now, and I don't think they'll have much of a chance to implement their ideas. They may, you know, they may find a way to get expanded health savings accounts, for example. But no, I think the direction is more in, instead of having the consumer bear the full cost of this health care, have the government do it.
Jack, maybe Obama splits the difference and gets something rather than nothing. Or are you on the go for it, Barack bandwagon?
He can this year, because the health care will be part of the budget. He can get something through. He can get the outlines of a plan through. The question is the efficacy of the plan, and will it be enough?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Michael Jackson makes an appearance this week. Jimmy Fallon gets a new show. And Paul Harvey signs off. Michael Jackson announced he'll perform a series of concerts in London this summer to a mass of cheering fans.
I love you. I really do. You have to know that. I love you so much. Really. From the bottom of my heart.
Jimmy Fallon kicked off his new show, Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, this week.
Smart man would leave now, but welcome to the first episode of Late Night with Jimmy Fallon. Good crowd.
And legendary broadcaster Paul Harvey died at 90. After 70 years on the air, Americans knew how he greeted listeners.
Hello, Americans. This is Paul Harvey. Stand by for news.
And how he said goodbye.
Paul Harvey, good day.
He's over and out, Paul Harvey, at 90. We're looking at a big week in the news. Where do you see some, any sign of hope in this economy? Tell us. And what do you make of Obama's secret letter to Moscow, Hillary's opening to Syria, her first trip to Israel? What about Darfur and the indictment of Sudan's leader on war crimes? Matthew Continetti's here from the Weekly Standard, Diane Brady of Businessweek magazine, and our own Jack Beatty. Diane, I want to ask you about the housing front. Foreclosure, our caller in Virginia is facing foreclosure, bankruptcy, and no health care, says it's too late for him. Who may be helped with this $70 billion bailout for those underwater with their mortgages, Diane?
Well, certainly the people who are facing foreclosure could be helped by this, and the prospect of getting their monthly payments lowered is certainly welcome. You know, one of the big issues, of course, is this isn't going to increase the value of the homes they're in, and many, many Americans essentially are living in homes that are worth far less than they paid for them, so it does not address that underlying issue. But the fact is, there are tens of millions of Americans who can possibly at least be able to stay in their homes for the next year, 2 years, until the economy starts to recover. So it's a very good start. Is it perfect? Of course not. But I'm personally very supportive, and many people I've spoken to in the business community are also supportive of taking some real action here.
Jack, what do you see on the housing front and with the beginning of this rollout this week of a bailout?
Well, I was struck with just what Diane was, the support that business groups were expressing for this, and that sort of even people who were conservative were expressing for it. And it just struck me as, my God, this housing crisis has been acute, really, for 6 months, and yet this is the first time we've tried to do something. It isn't enough. I mean, I've seen estimates that there are as many as 14 million people who are in the underwater category. The houses are worth paying more for the house than it's worth. And if they leave those houses, and if they go in the direction of walking away from those debts, that could just make everything worse. But it finally gets at the root of the problem that Matthew was talking about, these bad assets. And so many of them are in these terrible mortgages. So it's a start, and I think a heartening one.
Matt Continetti, it didn't exactly put bank stocks back on the way to recovery, not to mention the millions who it hasn't reached yet. But how about your view of the housing foreclosure bailout approach that's on the rails now?
Well, there are several elements to it. One is the subsidizing the people who can't pay their mortgages, the $75 billion amount. The other amount, which just the other part of it, which just passed the House, was this bill that will allow judges, bankruptcy judges, to basically renegotiate mortgages, including the payment amounts and the principal. They'll adjust the principal. This is something actually that the business community does not like. The mortgage industry does not like, because they figure they're going to have to pass those costs onto new, the people, the new lendees, for example, and such. However, it did pass the House. It may face some trouble in the Senate, where it was defeated last year when the Democrats tried it previously. But this has, there's so much going on, and the problem is so complicated that one problem I have with the Obama administration is they're very good at identifying problems and kind of saying, well, we need to fix the housing sector, or we need to fix the banking sector, or we need fiscal responsibility in Washington, or we need healthcare reform. But then when it gets to the actual implementation or design of these programs, they're not so good so far.
Well, we saw that on the Treasury front, but is that fair across the board at this point?
Well, look at the stimulus package. Here, Obama laid out clear principles for the stimulus package, and he was able to get it, the type of package he wanted from Congress. But I personally think it's not going to be that effective. Why? Because, well, the tax cuts are going to be ineffective because they amount to basically, what, about $8, I think, in some people's paychecks. That's not going to spur economic growth. A lot of the spending doesn't happen for a while, and the spending that does happen, it's not going to give us roads, most of it. It's going to give us a larger kind of, education and healthcare apparatus, and I don't know about the direct immediate economic consequences of that. But so the administration basically just signed it off to Congress and let them implement things that they had been wanting to do for a long time. That's the same thing with the housing. It's probably going to be the same thing with health care. And I'm just skeptical that doing that is going to fix the problem.
Jack Beatty, what do you say? I don't know if any president's ever come into office with quite such a wretched state of affairs storming all around. But how about the general approach so far? I mean, they're trying to fill was cabinet posts and now all the seats in the different departments and get policy up broadly and get details out and move it all fast. What grades are you giving, Jack?
I give them great grades for energy and for announcing purposes, but I join Matt in feeling the plans fall short. I don't think the president has seized quite the – in other words, I think he's got a bigger moment here than he realizes, a moment for much more radical reform than he's advocating. For example, on the bank plan, I mean, you have Paul Krugman today saying, why are we still – talking about this plan that will just keep these banks going under the same management, keep bleeding, you know, subsidies each quarter. We have to do something dramatic in the way of nationalization. Now, I mean, maybe that's not probable, but when you get economists saying more and more of them, you have even people like Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, saying we have to think about nationalization. It makes me think that Obama is shortening up on the bat, that he can take a bigger swing than he's taking. I think he can take a bigger swing on health care than he's taking. I think the public is ready for this kind of thing, and whether because of – I really think the issue here is political. The Democrats have a large blue dog caucus, and those folks don't want spending. They don't want government expansion. They do want deficit reduction. So I think that is limiting what he can do. It's great for the Democrats that they have a majority, but they have to pay deference to the people who make up that majority, and those are the folks that Obama has to work with, and I think they are shortening him up on the bat.
Get out the Louisville slugger, you say, and swing for the fences, Mr. President. Let's go to John in Florence, South Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment a little bit. I'm a financial advisor and so have been dealing in the trenches with lots of our clients and their attitudes over the last 6 months.
Yeah.
I was telling your screener earlier that the attitudes tend to fall into two camps. One is outright terror and the other one is extreme resignation. And I think that seems to indicate, to me at least, that you know, we have a lot of indicators that track consumer sentiment and consumer confidence.
Mm-hmm.
I think those two attitudes lead directly into a fundamental shift on how people are going to spend money in the future, which I think is going to have an impact on the recovery of the economy over the long term.
And a good one? Does that mark the bottom when you've got terror plus resignation, or is that the downward spiral, John?
Well, on the one hand, I think it's a signal that people are no longer blindly accepting the fact that, oh, well, it'll turn around. I watched a great program on television last night showing little clips from CNBC all the way down from 14,000 where the commentators were coming on and saying basically, okay, this is it. This is the bottom. And they were tracking the Dow all
at 13,
down.
12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, now 6 something.
Exactly. So I think that your average consumer has finally reached the point where they say, okay, I can no longer blindly trust that this is the end. I need to formulate some sort of strategy that I have in place, which I think is responsible. But I think that from the long term, we're going to have a serious and real shift in how people spend money. How that's going to affect the economy may be uncertain, but we have a largely consumer economy.
Yeah, John, we've got it. Let us take that to New York and Diane Brady on Wall Street. Diane, how about it? Do you see? I mean, there's a mixture of psychology and facts on the ground here. People hope for a comeback. John saying maybe the comeback will just be a fundamentally different thing.
I think there has been a reset, and the reality is that, frankly, we borrowed too much money for things that we didn't actually need, and we're not going to get access to that money again. The banks can't give it to us. Many foreigners are not going to give it to us. So I do think the American consumer is going to change their behavior going forward, but I also think the world is not ending. And so I think that the terror and the resignation are the two prevailing attitudes right now, but But there are some signs of recovery. I think the U.S. will get out of this. And some, you know, the fact is most people have not lost their jobs. Yes, they've lost a huge amount of stock wealth, those that have had money in the market, mm-hmm. and the markets are continuing to sink. But the reality is that most people are actually pretty much able to meet their expenses. They're just not going out and buying flat-screen TVs on credit at the moment, and they probably won't do that for quite some time to come.
Let's hear from Barb in Oak Park, Michigan. Hi, Barb. You're on the air.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I know you're going to be moving on into another segment here for foreign policy, but I just wanted to wrap up with, I think the president is doing a fantastic job, given the fact that over the past 8 years, what did we get? Nothing. And I think that let's not criticize him on every little thing that he does. Give the man a chance. My goodness, it's just getting to be a little bit much. But I think he's doing fantastic. He's moving forward. That's what we voted for, and he's doing that. And then as far as Rush Limbaugh goes, he's just a big fat bag of wind, and that man should just go away. And he's horrendous. Where does he come off? I mean, who does he think he is?
Well, he's an entertainer with a great big following and a political point of view. But we got your point of view right here as well, Barb, and we appreciate it. I do want to turn to some of the foreign policy issues this week, because there are some big ones. We heard this week that President Barack Obama had secretly written to his Russian counterpart, Dmitry Medvedev. Medvedev, that's always a mouthful, suggesting cooperation in blocking Iranian missile plans at a press conference this week. Obama said this was not a departure from what he has said in the past.
The way it got characterized, I think, was as some sort of quid pro quo. It was simply a statement of fact that I've made previously, which is that the missile defense program, to the extent that it is deployed, is designed to deal with not a Russian threat, but a Iranian threat.
And the Russian president said, no quid pro quo about exchanging a halt in the U.S. missile defense plan in Eastern Europe for Moscow's help in Iran.
It should be a global defense system, not a fragment located near the Russian border. The signals we're getting from Washington show they're ready to talk about it. And there are no trade-offs concerning Iran's nuclear program. We have been working very closely with the U.S. on this issue.
Matt Continetti, on this and other fronts, the Obama administration sort of bumping up against what had been Bush policy, looking in new directions. At least it feels that way. What do you see emerging here?
Well, it's called the reality principle.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality principle is that the Bush administration followed pretty much the same policy. This missile shield has always been, the Bush administration always said that the missile shield in Eastern Europe wasn't targeted toward Russia. It was targeted against the potential ballistic threat from Iran. And the Russians felt that it was targeting them, and so they opposed it. And they also weren't doing much to help get rid of the Iranian nuclear program. In fact, they're kind of, the legal aspects, they're aiding the Iranians with it. So Obama comes in, basically has a restatement of principles in that letter to Medvedev, and it's leaked to the New York Times. I'm not sure who comes out winning on top of this issue, because basically we're still at the status quo ante. Until all of the players have an interest in clamping down on Iran, the Iranian nuclear program is going to continue, and we haven't reached a point where Russia or China sees it in their, or even plenty of the European partners, Germany, for example, see it in their interests that a nuclear-free Iran is more important than business ties with Iran.
But, Jack, there was a feeling in the air this week of the Obama White House willing to take a different angle, maybe, with Moscow, willing to take a different angle in the Middle East, looking Hillary Clinton reaching out to Syria, maybe trying to surround action on Iran here. Do you see a new dynamic in that, Jack?
Yes, I do. I think they're thinking strategically, and the essence of strategy is to subordinate the lesser to the greater goal. The lesser goal here is this missile system in Eastern Europe, which I think is a bit of a farce. The greater goal is Iran. Trading one off for the other in any way you can is just a great gain. It's a gain when Hillary Clinton, again thinking strategically, said, as she said at a news conference this week, it is expected that Iran would be invited to this conference she's going to have. as a neighbor of Afghanistan, involving Iran in that problem. That, again, is thinking strategically. Going to Syria as a way to somehow isolate them from Iran to see if there's any chance you can find some space between them. That, again, is thinking strategically. So I think I'm just impressed with the way and with the deftness that they're showing here in this signaling.
Diane, finally to you on the international front, economically, as this week trundles behind us, I mean, Gordon Brown talking about needing global cooperation here. Do you see it emerging? Certainly everyone's dancing together in market direction lately.
I think the G20 is going to be a very important summit. There are these two tugging pulls, obviously. You've got everyone worried about jobs in their own countries, a lot of anger certainly directed toward the U.S., but there is this recognition that they do have to work together, and what people want to avoid is a situation like Japan, where it really did not enough was done, and that economy just essentially stayed static for more than a decade.
Down and down it's gone. Everybody looking for the bottom now in the U.S. and beyond its borders, and a rich full week behind us with the telescope still on the far horizon. Don't quite see it yet. Maybe something out there. Diane Brady with Business Week magazine, thank you very much for being with us today. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Matthew Continetti at the Weekly Standard. Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Jack Beatty, great to have you.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rose, and Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.